From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. David Hackworth was one of the finest military men of his generation. His valor during the Korean and Vietnam Wars made him this nation's most decorated living soldier. But in 1971, he lost faith in the U.S. military and left in anger. On this edition of Fresh Air, Colonel David Hackworth and the Odyssey of an American Warrior. Also today, we meet actor Paul Winfield, who's currently co-starring in the TV series Wise Guy. In the new reconstruction of the 1927 musical Showboat, the libretto begins with the line, "Niggers all work on the Mississippi." And that's the subject of Jeffrey Nunberg's language commentary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. When he retired from the military in 1971, Colonel David Hackworth was probably the most decorated officer in the American Army, but he was also one of the military's most outraged and bitter internal critics. At the age of 14, Hackworth ran away from his orphanage, and at 15 he volunteered for the Army. He received a battlefield commission in Korea when he was 20, and was wounded 4 times before he turned 21. In 1965, he went to Vietnam, where he was a battalion commander, held several advisory commands, and gained a reputation as a heroic and creative leader. But by 1971, he lost his faith in America's military leadership, and he detailed the reasons why on network television in an interview on ABC's Issues and Answers. After the interview was recorded, he filed for his retirement. For the past 18 years, Hackworth has lived in Australia, where he's become a successful entrepreneur. In his new memoir, About Face, Hackworth describes his life as a soldier and why he left the military that had for so long been his home. Hackworth is said to be the model for the character of the renegade Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando, in the film Apocalypse Now. I asked him where the similarity begins and ends.
I commanded a separate element down in the Delta, very similar to the character in Apocalypse Now, and he seemed to be a water walker of a colonel. That meant somebody that was talked about going to be onward and upward in the military system, and he quit, and he went to Cambodia and lobbed off heads and painted his face with camouflage and got very, very fat, as we saw in the movie. And he kind of went bananas, and I went to Australia and opened a snack bar and sold banana splits. So I think that's the connection, and that's not like a Hollywood ending for a movie. So I think that, yes, the character was modeled after me. I know that when I was in Australia and I was in my alternate lifestyle phase right after I got out of the Army, I was approached by a couple people who were producers who asked me to be a technical advisor for the film. And I was also told by Colonel Foley from the Army's public relations that it was modeled after me. So that's about what I know. I refused the job because I wasn't into war anymore.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get to that part a little bit later. Why did you make the Army your home until 1971?
I loved it. I love military men. I love the dedication, the discipline, the spirit, all those good things that make up warriors. And I came from a background in 1620. My family got very angry with King George, and they came to Virginia, and when it was a little colony, and with a musket in one hand and axe in the other, they chopped their way from Virginia to California, and I was kind of genetically programmed from that experience and from the tales of my dear grandmother about warriors to be a warrior. So that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to serve my country, and I couldn't think of anything a higher calling. And that's the point, that when I was a young soldier, being a soldier was a calling. It wasn't way to advance yourself to the higher levels.
Let's talk about your experiences in Vietnam. You went there in 1965 and stayed there off and on until 1971. You were there in many capacities, including working on a special mission to analyze some of the mistakes the American military was making in Vietnam. And you had many criticisms of the military over the years. I'd like to talk about some of those criticisms and how you reached those conclusions. first, you were saying that that you made the Army your home and everything, yet you became very critical of careerists in the military and of what was called ticket punching.
Well, I think, Terry, that you when you scope out the whole book, it goes from where I started my soldiering experience in Italy in kind of a time warp situation. I was in an army that didn't really exist anywhere but in Italy, and it was an army made up of sergeants that were the Burt Lancaster type characters from Here to Eternity, and it had that kind of old army 1930 kind of feel about it, and the discipline and the standards and the values I gained in those four hard years of being thumped on by NCO justice and all of that hardened me into a real believer and a really dedicated and professional soldier. I was taught the basics of if you don't get it right and do it right the first time around, you're going to do it wrong from then on. So those standards then continued. And, you know, we talk about at the end, here I started out in this great fine army that had this incredible discipline and standards, and I saw the army from then on go downhill, and I was always looking for that same goal. And the book is like 850-odd pages. Half of it deals with the Korean War, and it's come out to be the forgotten war. And those guys that fought there fought in terrible conditions against an overwhelming enemy, attacked us in great formations to where our machine guns were just running hot. And I describe all of this because that war was so important to understand Korea, from that setting of Korea, so you could then look very keenly at Vietnam, because the mistakes that we made in Korea, our army in the first year was sadly defeated. We went there under-equipped. We didn't have proper ammunition. Our soldiers hadn't been trained. Our generals were old and tired and fat and incompetent. And we got ourselves waxed, and we were driven back from the 38th parallel down to the Pusan perimeter. And it wasn't until we got great leadership, that was Matthew Ridgway, who turned the whole thing around, and that was one of the great military accomplishments of history, how one general can take a defeated army and very quickly shape it up and get us cracking, and we sailed north and just kicked the bejesus out of the North Koreans and the Chinese and so on. And when that Korean War ended, and the people in command of the army, the kind of Maxwell Taylor types who started all this self-serving careerist jazz, didn't want to know about Korea. So we didn't really learn anything. We swept those hard, bad, difficult, bloody lessons under the rug and got ourselves postured again to fight in Europe and tank battles and all of these good things that our senior leadership understood. And then came Vietnam, and we made all the mistakes again. What I saw was the military went from a high calling, a high profession, to just another job. And our generals went from that Ridgway type, that Patton type, that Gavin type, these inspirational warrior leaders, to corporate managers who had their PhDs and their masters from Harvard and so on, but didn't know diddly squat about leading soldiers and didn't care about their soldiers.
You were also very critical of the training that our troops had for guerrilla warfare. Now, later on, a lot of people were saying the same thing. You were saying this pretty early on. What were some of your experiences leading troops that made you realize how unprepared everybody was to fight in Vietnam?
There is training and there's training. And there was the training of going down and jumping into some place in Georgia and fighting for 3 or 4 weeks, but the individual soldier wasn't trained. He sat on the edge of his foxhole. People who fight the war wars are the individual soldiers. And in war, if that soldier is well-trained and knows the basics, it's like a football team. If you have a football team and you're good at blocking and tackling, then you don't need all that razzle-dazzle. You can go ahead and win the ball game just on your basic skills. And what happened in the military is these corporate generals didn't understand the need for blocking and tackling, and hence the Army got so involved in these big esoteric maneuvers that the training value went right down the slope, and it was shown in Vietnam. And I saw where I really saw the tragedy of it all was in a battalion I commanded at the latter stage of the war, which was called the 4th Battalion, 39th Infantry, and the 9th Division, when it was a battalion composed of what we called shake and bakes, of instant leaders, instant NCOs, instant officers, ran through Fort Benning for 12 weeks or 16 weeks and made sergeant, made lieutenant, and sent to the battlefield. Because everything in America is abracadabra, presto, instant type thing, and that's not the way to train an army. And so we made every possible mistake. Another experience I had in training was I commanded a training battalion at Fort Lewis, Washington. And a couple of examples was 50% of all casualties in Vietnam came from mines and booby traps, from these little insidious damn things that blew up and tore off your leg or killed you. And we had been into that war now 4 years at that time. And the total training that was given on mines and booby traps were 5 hours. There was no training devices like a little firecracker device that would explode when the soldier went through a training field and spray him with red paint so he'd know that he tripped a mine and was wounded. But at the same time, every full colonel and above in Vietnam had an air-conditioned trailer. And I became so insane about the way we were training, and I needed to know what it was all about and what we were happening, that I put on a private's uniform and wore a private's dog tags, a boy named Bob Cena, and went right through the training so I could find out what was happening, and I was appalled with what was happening. And so I took my troopers and trained them at night and trained them on Saturday and Sundays and so on to ensure that they got the right stuff. Because when they finished that training, they were on a jet airplane, and a few days later, they were walking in the jungles of Vietnam.
My guest is Colonel David Hackworth. We're talking about his experiences in the military. He's the most decorated living military man. He's retired in 1971, left the military after being greatly disillusioned by his experiences in Vietnam. His new book is called About Face. You talk about the overemphasis in Vietnam on capturing territory and how we'd capture territory and then abandon it a few days later. And in the meantime, many men would have lost their lives in capturing this territory. The greatest example of that and of the pointlessness of it was Hamburger Hill, where so many men died, and then the territory was given up shortly after. Did you have an equivalent experience where you had to capture territory, a lot of your men lost their lives, and then you were told to give it up just shortly after?
Well, I think in the beginning, because my training was Korea, and I originally entered the Vietnam War with that kind of experience. And so initially we were focused on terrain objectives, meaning grabbing a piece of ground. And as we went on, I learned that that was not the way to fight the war. The terrain didn't mean anything. The way to win that war was to make the enemy bleed. And our problem was that our senior leadership just fought the war as if it were World War II and just fought it all over again. And they didn't understand the nature of the war. And a point, Terry, is that that war was probably about 30% tactical and about 70% political, meaning to win the hearts and minds of the people, which is a tired cliche, but it wasn't all on the battlefield. And our generals, our senior generals, didn't understand that either, that we were kind of wham-bam, let's go blow them away type army. And we hadn't really worked out what the war was all about. After the war was over, a study was done at the War College, which revealed that 70% of the generals who were involved in high-level slots in Vietnam didn't understand what the objective is. Now, if you don't understand what the game plan is, you ain't going to win many ball games.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your experiences in the military, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Colonel David Hackworth. His new book is called About Face. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Colonel David Hackworth. He's America's most decorated living soldier, but during the Vietnam War, he became disillusioned and bitterly ended his 25-year Army career. He became an expatriate and has lived in Australia since the early 1970s. He's just written an autobiography titled About Face, The Odyssey of an American Warrior. One of your missions in Vietnam was to take over a sick battalion, a battalion that was in disarray, and to try to turn them around. When you got there and saw the troops, you found that at the command post there were portable toilets, plastic coolers, but the troops were living in complete filth and disarray. They weren't even covering their feces. That there was just this incredible difference between how the two groups were living. Would you describe that a little bit?
Well, that was the 4th Battalion, 39th. They kind of called themselves the Hard Luck Battalion because shy of my arriving, they had kind of waited around in minefields for 6 months and taken 500 or 600 casualties and hadn't really engaged the enemy. And it was a very demoralized unit. And my commander told me that he wanted it shaped up. And I think I was kind of brought in from the United States for that particular job. And so it took every bit of experience of my previous 20 years to get this battalion cracking. And it was just going back and instilling in those kids the basics. They were a drafty battalion. They were the shake and bakes I described earlier. And it was just a question of making sure that they did things the right way. And as days passed, we got better and better and better. We didn't fight in minefields. You know, I was taught as a little kid that a minefield was a no-no, and in World War II, we didn't play in minefields. But in Vietnam, minefields were where the enemy was. The whole focus was on body count. So you went into minefields, and it just blew the guys' brains away because every time they put their foot down, they didn't know whether they were going to have a foot, going to have a leg, going to have a life. And do that for 365 days, and hey, it'll do something to your brain. And so I had to change that, and I had to win these young 19 and 20-year-old boys to my way of fighting, which was, I'm on your side. I am not going to waste you. You are the most precious asset in the world, and I'm not going to just slam you up against a minefield or an enemy in a fixed position for glory or for a few medals or to make some points with my boss. And so I was a very frugal commander, and that spirit went down to my troops, as did my emphasis on the basics. And within 5 months, that battalion started calling themselves the Hardcore Battalion. And in the chapter in the book, I call it the Hardcore Battalion. And they, at the end, had killed over 2,500 enemy at the price of 25 American dead, 25 of our comrades who were killed. And that is, to me, the end result. If you could do that with a drafty battalion that started in that kind of raggedy condition, and they turned out to be a Praetorian Guard, it was just a byproduct, Terry, of leadership.
You didn't want to lead your troops into hopeless or impossible situations where you'd just be setting them up to be killed. Yet you had to go on some missions that you didn't believe in. And I think the kind of gravest example of that was Cambodia. You were against the bombing of Cambodia, but you had to participate in that mission.
Well, Cambodia was too little too late. We should have gone into Cambodia in 65, the minute the American forces got into the war. General Westmoreland, who was the commander-in-chief in Vietnam, should have said to the president, hey, listen, I want to blow away those sanctuaries. I want to blow away Haiphong. I want to blow away the Red River Delta dikes. I want to flood the whole bloody country. I want to win that war. I don't want to go in there with one arm tied behind me. I don't want to go in there gradually. If America's to fight a war, we got to win that war. And if the president wouldn't give him the good things he needed, that's the combat power and the free hand, then he should have resigned. My bitch with Cambodia was simply this. I believe that we should blow away the sanctuaries. We went into it 5 years too late. But What the basic thing that got me was, I believe in America and the ideals of America. And when we went to Cambodia and we didn't tell the Cambodian government, our allies, we didn't tell the U.S. ambassador in Phnom Penh, we just went in blatantly, not unlike the Nazis went into Poland or the Japanese into Pearl Harbor. And I wasn't into that. And I just, that wasn't the American way. And that's the thing that kind of broke my heart.
In 1971, shortly after your experiences in Cambodia, you decided to go public with your disillusionment about the American military. You chose as the forum Issues and Answers, the ABC News program, and you did an interview on there that got incredible attention. What made you decide to go public at that time? Did you feel like you'd already been through channels and that hadn't worked?
Well, I'd been in Vietnam. I'd been in Vietnam a long time, and I had tried my very best to inform everybody in power that we were losing the war. In 1966, I had told the Chief of Staff of the Army, Harold Johnson, we were losing the war. In 1968, I had told the Chief of Staff of the Army, Westmoreland, that we'd botched the war and we were losing it. In 1969, I told the Secretary of the Army, Stanley Reeser, the same thing. And I told anybody and everybody that I could grab by the short of the stock and hold long enough that we were fighting the war wrong, we were paying an incredible price, and no one would listen. I was telling everyone in military publications and writing. Everybody was printing my word, but still nothing was being done. The hardcore battalion, this battalion you described earlier, went from heartbreak to hardcore, and we had this incredible battle experience, and the battalion was able to wax the enemy in every engagement with 100 enemy dead, 4 American wounded, and stuff like that. Nobody tried to learn from those hard lessons that we were fighting, and it just was like water on a rock. It went on and on and on until the rock broke, and when the rock broke, I said, look, we are a country of the people, by the people, for the people. I'm going to tell the people because I've told the institution and it hasn't worked. So in a big, naive 40-year-old boy, I told everybody, and thinking, oh, well, now that's going to make some change. Sure did. I found myself with like a sledgehammer coming down on my tender little brain.
For example, what did the military do? What was the response?
Well, I didn't know anything about whistleblowing. And it's a taboo in the military to attack the military as such. And here I was a regular officer doing it. And remember, I didn't come up. I came up through the ranks from private to sergeant and sergeant to lieutenant and so on. So I didn't understand it was taboo. I had always, when I was a little kid in Italy, Eisenhower said to me, well, what do you think about the chow? And I said it was terrible, and he got it fixed. So I thought, all you have to do is tell your commander, and he'll get it fixed. And so I was telling my commander, and General Westmoreland didn't quite appreciate what I had to say, and that's when the world fell in on me. And it fell in on me, the most obvious way of attacking me was through my credibility, that I was either nuttier than a fruitcake or I was a bum, and I had done all these bad things, and hence you shouldn't believe what Hackworth has to say. So basically that was kind of the campaign of terror that I endured for a few months. While that was happening, my little constitutional rights were pretty well shredded.
When you retired from the military and your own military record was called into question, a couple of the things that were raised were controversial things that you had been doing while you were in Vietnam. Like, for instance, you ran, a massage parlor whorehouse?
Well, I had the best little whorehouse this side of the Mekong Delta River. But what was important, the reason that we had it was not unlike the French Army when they were in Vietnam. They had the same type of service for their little troops. And it was because I had a team composed of mostly senior NCOs and officers down in the Delta who were isolated in this little island situation. We had syphilis that was in epidemic proportions around this area. We had heroin in the same kind of condition. So I put everything off limits. And warriors are warriors, and they like to fight, and they like to do other good things. So instead of taking the problem of having the heroin brought into my base or the syphilis brought in, we corrected that by providing that good service for the Allied troops. And, you know, the function of a good commander is to look after his soldiers, and I always looked after my soldiers.
You had a heroin amnesty program. Describe briefly how the program worked.
Well, at that time, about 20% of the U.S. command in Vietnam had a problem with heroin. And so what I did with my doc, a medical doctor, medically trained and all that good stuff, was was very easy to see who was sticking a needle in his arms, because we were in the tropics and they had their sleeves rolled down. So it was just a question of identifying those guys, putting them under a medical program the doc ran. He brought them down on morphine, and then we got them home. And the Army's way of dealing with this was to give everyone a bad conduct discharge. And I felt that they were victims, not unlike they'd been shot on the battlefield. And I felt it was my responsibility to get them home in good order. And so that's what our program was about. At the end, when they went out through Camp Alpha, they had to urinate in a little bottle, and this bottle could be read, and it could be told if they had been on heroin in the last 6 or 8 months. So I just sent another boy with them. We just out-G'd the whole system, and the other boy took a leak in the bottle, and they read out his urine, and the guy that had been using the heroin went home and was free, and he didn't have a $300 or $400 a day habit, and he could walk away from that terrible experience. So again, I was looking after my troops, and as long if I hadn't bit the hand that fed me, none of this would have come up. But
well, how did you get away with it for as long as you did?
Well, we were very competent and good, and we were winning all the ball games. And it's my experience that the commanders will suffer all kinds of insubordination and bizarre, weird behavior as long as you're winning ball games. And we indeed won ball games right until the day I left that country.
What kind of shape do you think the American military is in today?
Well, I've gone to the 7th Division, 25th Division, the National Training Center, and I haven't been at the flagpole, but I've been down with troops at the squad, at the platoon, at the battalion. I'm very impressed with the young leaders. The young regular leaders are outstanding. The young NCOs and officers up to battalion level, which is the only place I've been, I'm very impressed. The Army looks very much like that damn great Army that we had 62, 63, 64, 65 before we bloodied it and broke its sword on Vietnam. So maybe we have learned, and I think that where I have been, which are the light divisions, which are the ones who got the mission to fight in Latin America, to fight in third world countries, to fight in wars like we've fought in Vietnam, I think they want to know what happened. And again, after the Vietnam War, the Army again, like Korea, swept it all under the rugs and oriented themselves to fight in Europe. But today, the guys I talk to, the guys at battalion level and below, want to know those hard lessons. So maybe we've learned. And as I said earlier, the Army never learns from its past. It's never been introspective. We always go into the current war with the memory and the tactics and the strategy of the previous war. Maybe at long last we've learned, and maybe, and I'm hoping that my book will serve somewhat as a guide, a training manual, a primer on the experiences, my experiences of the Cold War, so we just don't forget it and make those same mistakes over and over again.
David Hackworth, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for your time. And my guest has been Colonel David Hackworth. His new book, About Face, The Odyssey of an American Warrior, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with reporter Wolf Blitzer. He's the Washington correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. His new book is Territory of Lies, the exclusive story of Jonathan J. Pollard, the American who spied on his country for Israel. Blitzer was the one reporter that Pollard chose to tell his story to when Pollard was first imprisoned. I hope you can join us.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Back in the late 60s, actor Paul Winfield turned down a steady role on TV in order to further hone his craft with a theater company. That gamble seems to have paid off. Winfield's start on Broadway, received an Oscar nomination for his role in the movie Sounder, and starred as Martin Luther King in a TV miniseries. Now he's back on TV as a record mogul in the TV series Wise Guy. Coming up, we meet Paul Winfield. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new recording of works by Sir Peter Maxwell Davies. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the different terms white writers have used to refer to blacks in musicals, novels, movies, and television, and how these terms have changed with the times. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. The controversial Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion came under review by the High Court today. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports on the start of oral arguments over a Missouri law restricting abortions.
The crux of today's argument came when former Solicitor General Charles Freed stepped to the lectern on behalf of the Bush administration and said, "Today the United States asks this court to overrule its decision in Roe v. Wade. We are not asking the court to unravel the fabric of privacy rights established in decisions before Roe," he said. "Rather, we're asking the court to pull this one thread." Justices Kennedy and O'Connor, two of the court's pivotal votes, then began asking questions about the court's 1965 privacy decision, striking down state laws that banned contraceptives in the home. Justice Kennedy, your position, Mr. Freed, is the contraceptive ruling that decision should be retained. Answer, exactly, Your Honor. Justice Kennedy, does the case stand for the proposition that there's a right to determine whether to procreate? Answer, it surely does not stand for that proposition. Justice O'Connor, do you say there's no fundamental right to decide whether to have a child or not? A right to procreate? Do you deny that the Constitution protects that right? Answer, I would hesitate to formulate the right in such abstract terms. The Supreme Court is not expected to decide the Missouri case until this summer. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The comedienne who dominated television comedy for more than two decades died today at the age of 77. Lucille Ball was recovering from open-heart surgery at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles when she suffered a ruptured abdominal aorta. Ball was considered the queen of situation comedy and a pioneer of the sitcom format. Comedian George Burns said, quote, "I and 100 million others will miss her." A Chicago father has been charged with murder in the death of his brain-damaged infant son. The man disconnected the child's life support system while pointing a gun at hospital staff. The baby died within half an hour. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
Rudy Linares of Cicero and his wife came to visit their 16-month-old son Samuel at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke Hospital at about 1 o'clock this morning. Samuel had been on a respirator since swallowing a toy last August. After visiting with the child for 20 minutes, Linares pulled a .357 Magnum, ordered a nurse out of the pediatric intensive care unit, and held security staff at bay as he disconnected his son's respirator. "I'm not here to hurt anyone," Linares is quoted as saying. "I'll only hurt you if you try to plug my baby back in." Linares sat crying as the child died in his arms 30 minutes later. Linares and his wife had been scheduled to visit a lawyer later this week to force the hospital to disconnect their child support system. I'm Jackie Leiden in Chicago.
Iran today said it's suing the United States in the World Court. The Islamic Republic says the U.S. has run a spy ring using high-ranking Iranian officials. Tehran also accuses West Germany of being involved. The Iranians say the CIA trained armed bands to carry out subversive activities inside Iran. A number of people have been arrested, but the Iranians have not released exact numbers. On Friday, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said of the Iranian announcement of a CIA spy ring, "We frankly don't know what they're talking about." It's Thursday morning in Beijing, and despite Chinese government threats of a crackdown, student leaders at Beijing University are vowing to push ahead with a demonstration in support of democratic reforms. Some students are saying they're prepared to die for the cause. More than 70,000 students from 41 different schools in Beijing have been boycotting classes since Monday. Many have participated this week in unprecedented sit-ins at the government offices as well as Communist Party offices. In advance of the rally, school officials broadcast warnings over loudspeakers, announcing that anyone participating in a rally for democracy would be punished. At Beijing University, a number of students responded by throwing bottles from dormitory windows. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sir Peter Maxwell Davies is one of the major British composers to follow the generation of Benjamin Britten. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says his work can be difficult and forbidding, but Lloyd says a new album called A Celebration of Scotland proves that Maxwell Davies can also write skillful music in a lighter, more immediately appealing style.
The best-known music of Sir Peter Maxwell Davies is filled with madness, religious hysteria, heavy symbolism, and prickling irony. He's always been interested in medieval and Renaissance music, and he often incorporated elements of them into his own complex 12-tone schemes. Then he might undercut his high intensity by inserting a foxtrot on an out-of-tune honky-tonk piano. His most famous work is probably Eight Songs for a Mad King, which is a fascinating music theater piece about George III, or a madman who thinks he's George III. But he's also written gentler pieces, like a hilariously updated children's version of Cinderella, an opera not only written for, but performed by children, or Le Jongleur de Notre Dame, which employs a real juggler and musical instruments speaking the lines. In 1970, Maxwell Davies fell under the spell of the Orkney Islands, north of Scotland, and now lives there part of the time. His symphonies echo the brooding sounds of the northern sea. But the shorter works on this recent album, A Celebration of Scotland, show him mellower, more interested in recreating the charm and folk life of the Orkneys. The featured work on this album is an Orkney wedding with sunrise, with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra conducted by Maxwell Davies. It's a delightful piece commissioned for the Boston Pop Centennial in 1985, a 12-minute tone poem depicting the progress or disintegration of a wedding party, including a procession, dances, and the effects of both high spirits and good spirits. Sunrise ends the revelries with the arrival of a bagpiper, who in live performances actually marches down the aisle onto the stage. I also like a concert overture called Jimmack the Postie, a more formal and touching portrait of the postman on the Isle of Hoy. Maxwell Davies never uses actual folk tunes. His folk music is completely original. On this album, though, are also several orchestrations of earlier music, including a group of seven Renaissance Scottish dances. My favorite pieces on the album are the choral works for children, performed by the choir of St. Mary's Music School. Seven Songs Home follow a child during the hour it takes him to get home from school. Here's Cold Tractor, a dialogue between the child and a Mr. Spence who's having trouble starting his useless mullygrubs of a tractor. Maxwell Davies himself plays two piano solos, interludes from his anti-nuclear cabaret, The Yellow Cake Review. He wrote this piece to protest open-pit uranium mining on Orkney. One of the solos, Farewell to Stromness, actually became a sort of hit in a soft rock arrangement that probably missed some of the irony in Maxwell Davies's nostalgia.
Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Sir Peter Maxwell Davies' album, A Celebration of Scotland, on the British Unicorn label. This is Fresh Air. The current storyline on the TV show Wise Guy is about corruption in the record industry. Most of the guest stars come from the music world, such as Deborah Harry, Glenn Frey, and Tim Curry. One of the actors who has no ties to the music business is Paul Winfield. He plays Isaac Twine, the head of Shakala Records. Winfield grew up in the Watts area of Los Angeles and has had a long career on stage, in the movies, and on television. Winfield was recently seen on television in The Women of Brewster Place and The Charmings. He got an Academy Award nomination for his starring role in the film Sounder. He also got an Emmy nomination for his role as Dr. Martin Luther King in the 1977 miniseries based on King's life. Now you can see him as a compulsive gambler and record company head in Wise Guy.
Isaac Twine.
Let me turn over.
I know. Oh, man. I love a man with brass, you know. I mean, anybody willing to put himself and his money into a crapshoot business like this has got my admiration. Hey, sit down.
It's interesting in a way. I think most of the roles I've seen you in have been more serious roles, in the sense of that this is a very kind of flamboyant character that you're playing in
well,
Wise Guy.
Yeah, and I like playing those kinds of roles,
mm-hmm.
and in particularly in Wise Guys, what they call an arc, where you have about seven chances to make it even bigger, doing seven different shows, you have a chance to grow and to explore a lot of other facets of the character.
I have to ask you something about your voice. Your voice has always seemed to me to be the kind of voice that somehow really lends itself to classical theater. Do you know what I mean? And I was wondering, you know, people think of actors as just kind of builds in a way and physical expression, but I think a voice has so much to do with an actor's performance. And I'm not sure what the question is, but I think it has something to do with how your voice affects the roles that you get.
Well, thank you. That's one of the major tools, but I don't have, I'm very envious of other actors' voices. I think a voice like James Earl Jones, who has that great resonance. And
you don't think you have a great voice?
Well, it never, I don't like listening to it, I'll tell you that. It doesn't, I always feel that, well, one of the things I like working on the stage is because I really do then train really working on my voice and the things you can get out of it, but I don't take lessons and do all the things I should be doing if I was a better actor. But it's but it's the words that you're dealing with in really great plays of Chekhov or Shakespeare, and it's and you do more demands are made upon you and on your voice. But thank you very much. I'm glad somebody thinks so.
One of your first big breaks is when you were cast in The Dutchman by Leroy Jones, now Amiri Baraka. And his early plays were very radical, both in politics and in sensibility. Did that radicalism suit you at the time?
Well, yes, it did. Although I had a lot of very white friends, I think they didn't really understand me, and particularly when we were doing that play, as you may or may not remember, the last scene of The Dutchman, the young black man has this tremendously, like, five-page harangue about racial injustice, and he's going to cut her throat, and it don't push us too far, because there's always this, right under the surface, all of this anger and rage and hatred. I mean, I thought I did that speech really well, and my white friends would come, and I said, well, what did you think of the place? Oh, it's just da 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 da. I said, yeah, but what do you think of that last scene? He said, well, what do you mean? What last scene? I said, you know, with that long speech. They said, "Oh, gee, I don't remember very much about it." it sort of went over their heads, I guess. But I found it. It got a lot of. Things off my chest, anyway.
Well, did that affect your ability to get cast in other roles at the beginning? I'm just thinking that when you get the reputation as maybe being radical, some people won't come near you.
Well, no. I was, and actually I think it sort of helped because I played an awful lot of angry black young men, which came right after that, which when Hollywood sort of like really sort of started paying attention when just the outskirts of their town was being burned down. They said, who are these people? So, I mean, I played a lot of radicals and what have you, but that was the Dutchman was very good training and preparation for that. I think generally, I guess actually, I really owe it all to Dr. King because before the Civil Rights Movement, I think in the South, most of white America, middle America, really didn't have much contact. They really cared very much about black people or really knew anything about them as if we really existed on the other side of the moon.
Well, you mentioned Martin Luther King. You played the role of King in a television miniseries.
Yeah.
That's it's like a big responsibility to play somebody like that.
Scared me to death, I tell
you. Well, go ahead.
It was awesome, and the more I was lucky enough to have about 4 months preparation and a chance to talk to people who knew him and to travel around, and the more I found out about him, the scarier it got. Because for one thing, I don't know how you really play an intellectual, which I think he truly was. I mean, the only time I saw him was at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles here in the '60s, and I have to admit that I was not impressed by him. Adam Clayton Powell spoke. It was riveting. I mean, we stood to our feet. Then this sort of very short and sort of unassuming black man came up, spoke very quietly, but also with a southern accent. And being, I guess, from the West and sort of, I thought, sophisticated, I didn't, he just didn't take people with southern accents very seriously. I mean, I think if Einstein had came in and said, well, I just discovered the theory of relativity, you know, that nobody would take it seriously. So, I mean, it was But as I got older and certainly learned more about Dr. King and about the... it's certainly changed my life, and also just the response of people who had met him.
You mentioned how there was a time when you didn't take people with Southern accents that seriously, and I'm thinking about the movie Sounder, where you played a man from the rural South in 1933 during the Depression.
Yeah.
Was that a difficult role for you to take on, since you were from the city, you're from Watson?
That was my first time in the South, and it was also quite an awakening for me.
Uh-huh.
The accents weren't, I mean, you don't, the accent wasn't hard, and we all sort of softened it up anyway, just wanted to make them basically human beings. But the South at that time was truly a revelation for me, and it was a big. You'd go by these enormous, beautiful plantations, and some you could even get inside, and you'd see the wonderful craftsmen and the wonderful, truly stylish, luxurious style of living that they obviously enjoyed, and then you go in the back and you couldn't help but appreciate it. I mean, beauty is beauty, craftsmanship is craftsmanship, and then you go in the back where the slave quarters were, who made all of this possible, and as a young black man, it's sort of hard to describe, but it stays with me quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other day I was flipping the stations on television and came upon you in a role in RPM, which was one of those, you know, Campus Revolution movies, with Anthony Quinn as the campus president. But I was wondering if that happens to you a lot, that you're flipping around the stations and there you are in a movie.
Yeah, it does. And it's sometimes I watch it and sometimes I don't. But it's interesting. You have a lot of different constituencies when you go out there, and people say, I just saw you, and what? And and they have that particular, it's a science fiction film, or it's something perhaps a little better. It's interesting, and it's sometimes fun.
You were saying that depending on what movie somebody's just seen you in, they have a different impression of you. You know, if they've seen you in science fiction, then that's what they think of you. If they've seen you in an action film, that's what they think. Are you being entertained by seeing yourself in Wise Guy now?
I look forward to it. Yes, I do.
Actor Paul Winfield is currently appearing on the TV series Wise Guy. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, I'm sure you're covering the Missouri abortion case on the Supreme Court.
That's right. Arguments today at the Supreme Court in a case that some people say could lead to the revision or the overthrow of Roe v. Wade. Some less civil arguments outside the court. Several people were arrested in demonstrations. We'll also be hearing about the two fusion scientists who appeared on Capitol Hill today. Look at hot fusion, the way they did it the old-fashioned way. A talk with Yogi Berra, and today also a remembrance of Lucille Ball, who died at age 77.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The language used by whites to portray blacks in American plays, movies, and novels has changed as frequently as racial stereotypes themselves. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg explores how one musical, Showboat, has come full circle.
John McGlynn's new recording of Kern and Hammerstein's Showboat is an impressive piece of musical scholarship, a faithful reconstruction of the original 1927 production. But a lot of the attention it's gotten has focused on one word that McGlynn restored to the libretto. You hear it first in the opening lines of the musical, as sung by the chorus of black stevedores.
He has a word on the Mississippi. He has a word.
Hammerstein meant the line as a piece of gritty realism to open the first American musical play that would try to deal seriously with social issues like miscegenation and race prejudice. It was a time when white writers and artists were discovering blacks and racial themes, and a lot of them seemed to take a particular satisfaction in having their black characters use the word nigger. O'Neill did it in The Emperor Jones and All God's Chillen. And there was a popular novel about Harlem life called Nigger Heaven by Carl Van Vechten, who served as a cultural middleman between the black artist of the Harlem Renaissance and the artistic world downtown. By the standards of the time, these writers were outspoken liberals. In fact, Hammerstein would go on to treat interracial themes much more boldly two decades later in South Pacific, particularly in the famous song You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. He didn't intend the word nigger malevolently. He used it because he heard blacks using it among themselves. It was an insider's word which gave him and his white audience a sense of vicarious participation in the black culture. To be sure, blacks recognized the condescension in all this. When Paul Robeson sang the part of Joe in the 1928 London production of Showboat, one black critic wrote, "If anyone were to call him a nigger, he'd be the first to get offended, and there he is singing nigger, nigger before all those white people." In any event, the word was cut from later versions of the musical, which tended to soft-pedal its racial themes and to play it as a colorful costume drama about the Old South. For the 1936 film version, niggers was changed to darkies, which in turn became colored folks in the 1946 Broadway revival. Then it was Here We All Work on the Mississippi, when Frank Sinatra sang it in White Tales, in Till the Clouds Roll By, Arthur Freed's 1946 film biography of Jerome Kern. And by the time Freed made his 1951 film version of Showboat, nobody was working on the Mississippi. The chorus was cut entirely. I'd like to be able to see the march of progress in all this, but all it really shows is an increasing refinement in white liberal presumption. The same sensibility that led Hammerstein to use nigger in 1926 was what led me and my friends to refer to blacks as spades when we were apprentice hipsters hanging out at Lower East Side jazz clubs in the early 60s. It was a sort of play-acting at being black that led Norman Mailer to describe the hipster as the white Negro. The hipsters are gone now, but the white Negro has become an archetype of mainstream culture. You can find him in all the black cop, white cop buddy movies, in the scene where the two trade good-natured racial banter. The idea is that a hero like Mel Gibson, Robert Urich, or Nick Nolte can get away with talking in a way that would get an ordinary white guy killed, because their black sidekicks recognize their underlying soulfulness. I suppose we should be thankful that these movies don't have scores by Jerome Kern. At least we won't have to deal with embarrassing revivals of Lethal Weapon and 48 Hours 60 years from now.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time we meet writer Lynn Sharon Schwartz. Her new novel, Leaving Brooklyn, is the coming-of-age story of a 15-year-old girl who wishes real life was more like the books she reads. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker returns with the Tucker Top 5, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Field of Dreams. It's about an Iowa farmer's baseball fantasy. It stars Kevin Costner and is based on the novel Shoeless Joe. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.